Hello and a very warm welcome to Section D, Monocle 24's dedicated weekly design show. I'm Henry Rhys Sheridan, standing in for Josh Fennett, who's away taking in the sights and sounds of Singapore. On today's show, we bring you some sartorial delights as we look ahead to the October fashion special of Monocle magazine.
NAR is renowned for its buffalo horn buttons, and the industry has kind of plummeted. But there's this one particular factory that is doing sort of an amazing job at keeping the tradition going.
To kick off the show, Monocle's design editor Josh Fennett and fashion researcher Jamie Waters discuss hats, buttons, and far-flung retailers. Just some of the stories to look forward to in the magazine. Then, our New York Deputy Bureau Chief Megan Billings pays a visit to Portsmouth, Ohio to report from a rejuvenated shoelace factory. Plus,
we're just flooded nowadays with stuff that's been produced by a computer. And people don't even notice it anymore. They look past it. So if you want something that's really going to stand out, it has to be done by hand.
I head to Amsterdam to bring you a report on Letterheads 2016, a traditional sign painters meetup. All that coming up right here in Section D, Monocle 24's dedicated design show. Here at Midori House, we're thick in the throes of production for the October edition of Monocle magazine, a fashion special that'll bring you 64 pages of sharp silhouettes and general dapperness. As you can imagine, Monocle's fashion researcher Jamie Waters has had his work cut out. Here he is speaking to the magazine's design editor Josh Fennett about some of the stories coming up in the issue.
One of the features that I'm excited about is looking at factories that make the really small part of clothing. So we visited a button maker in Japan.
So this is like your YKK zips, the aspects of all clothing that are kind of unanimous. They're seen around the world and they're very important.
Exactly. And I think we see them on everything, but you don't think that much about, you know, who is this company that's making all the most amazing buttons, the most amazing zips, or doing the threads that go into these shirts.
So what's so good about these buttons then, Jamie, these Japanese buttons?
So they're a buffalo horn buttons, and it's this factory in Nara in Japan. And basically what's happened to the industry is when a lot of fashion factories were moved to China or to cheaper outposts in Asia, the factories that sort of surrounded them making the small parts also sort of were moved. Mm-hmm. So the NAR is renowned for its buffalo horn buttons, and the industry has kind of plummeted. But there's this one particular factory that is doing sort of an amazing job at keeping the tradition going.
And so they remain high-end. I presume they remain expensive. That's a lot of the reason for the offshoring of these products, is the fact that it becomes so expensive to produce them in countries like Japan. But why do you think the market's persisted for these guys? And what sort of scale are we talking? They're making millions and millions of buttons a year, or are they making four or five for one collection of an amazing fashion brand?
There's about 25 people in the team. So, I mean, I think that's always going to limit you in terms of the scale, but they've targeted the high end of the market. They're not allowed to speak about any of their current clients, but I know that they used to make all the buttons for Burberry when Burberry was all manufactured in Japan. That changed last year. So literally every Burberry coat that you would see with buffalo horn buttons was made in this factory in Japan. So I think they've kind of cornered the luxury market. And it's sort of interesting to even hear about the process. Like, they get these curved buffalo horns delivered to the factory floor, and then the workers kind of whittle them down into these very delicate buttons that we'll, you know.
And from a buffalo's horn to something we might wear on our heads, you took a little trip with a photographer. So we are visiting a milliner in France, is that correct?
Absolutely, yeah. So in this little village called Caussade, which was and still is the hat-making capital of France, and it kind of thrived in the 1950s. There were 55 factories in this, really, it's a village. It's got sort of 7,000 people.
And we're talking about felt hats, straw hats, but not berets, presumably.
Not berets, yeah, felt and straw. I mean, back then it was
just felt and
straw.
Not to invoke too much of a cliche about French hats, but they don't make berets, okay.
No, they're, so the main industry used to be these straw hats, which they call canotiers, which are basically boaters. So there used to be 55 factories. There's only three today because the whole hat industry around the world has basically plummeted. And the CEO was really interesting because he's very fiery. And he said, you know, the car killed the hat, to quote him directly. And he said, you know, hats are a protective, functional item. People used to walk and cycle everywhere. And when cars came around and everyone would just drive and the roof covers your head, there was no longer a need. So they were kind of made redundant.
I think we've broken one of the most macro trends in the world ever there. People looking for up-to-the-minute advice will be delighted to hear that the car has actually killed the hat. But you say it's still a hat-making capital. There's only three factories there. To what extent is this another example, as you talked about with the with these buffalo horn buttons, of factories only being able to survive by fulfilling very small, very expensive orders?
It's exactly that. So what this particular factory, which is now the biggest hat factory in France, the way that they've survived is they have cornered the high-end fashion market. So they used to make all their own line of products, but now more than half of their, or about half of their offerings are made for Hermès, Saint Laurent, Comme des Garçons, you know, all these big Parisian labels and Japanese labels. And there's this great kind of idea or image of these traditional craftsmen who are now, you know, making hats for the likes of Comme des Garçons. And the CEO said, you know, they'll get sent all these quite bizarre fabrics from Comme, you know, with holes in them and very obscure and strange patterns and textures. And then these elderly craftsmen are kind of working out what to do with it and with these very sort of high-end and haute couture.
Let's move on to the Pacific Northwest.
Yeah, so
what have you got for us in Oregon that's not about Portland? Maybe the only story ever that's been about Oregon but not Portland.
I know, and that was exactly what we set out to do. We wanted to write about far-flung retailers and this idea that city rents have, you know, gone up a lot and it's perhaps not as attainable for some people to open their dream fashion boutique in the city. So we've looked at a few entrepreneurs who have gone as far away as possible. And there's this one guy, Tyler Hayes, and he's set up a shop called M. Crow. And it's in this tiny, tiny town, if you can call it that, called Lostine, which is a town of 200 people in Oregon, and it's sort of nestled among the mountains. And he's a designer from Philadelphia, or he was originally from Lostine, so he's kind of returned. But the thing that I like is that he sells all these sort of selvedge denim jeans and these quite cool fashion items. But of course, to keep the cash register ticking over, he also sells everyday essentials. So he'll sell like cans of beer and camping supplies. And it's kind of this idea that you make it work. So it's a destination for designers and sort of fashion conscious people. But then he also serves the local community. It's a general store in essence.
Yeah, I suppose there are a few different things to consider there. I mean, when you don't get as much footfall, you will obviously get a cheaper rent, but actually selling the items is a problem. So it becomes about space making, right? Can you tell us a little bit about what the place looks like? I mean, does it look like a general store? Are there boxes of cereal next to your jeans and things that people need every day? How's he managed the traditional look of a fashion shop with a general store?
I think he's done it really well. It basically looks like what you would imagine a sort of general store in the middle of nowhere to look like, except it's kind of been given a bit of a makeover. So there are sort of these busts of animals all over the walls and things like that. I mean, there are cereals and all these things lining the shelves, but the space is very clean and very light. And also there are these rows of clothes sort of among it all, sleek clothes. So I think he stayed true to that idea of a sort of old school general store. And the general store is 100 years old. He's just kind of given it a bit of an overhaul. But I think he's kept that kind of rustic identity.
So from a shop in Oregon to horn buttons in Japan, three stories from the forthcoming October issue of Monocle magazine. And the style survey edited by our very own Jamie Waters. Thank you, Jamie.
Now, if you're in the mood for an aglet, you're in luck, because our next report shines a spotlight on an overlooked fashion staple, the humble shoelace. The small Ohio town of Portsmouth was once a hub of the shoemaking industry, having a tannery, a tack factory, and two companies making wooden lasts. Soul Choice, a shoelace factory, is one of the last holdouts of this manufacturing base. After the century-old company fell into bankruptcy in 2009, Brian Davis and Ryan Bouts bought the assets and revitalized the company. Today, it's boasting clients such as New Balance and Timberland. Monocle's Megan Billings brings us this report from the factory.
Portsmouth was notorious for multiple shoe manufacturing facilities, very big in the footwear industry, dating back to the early 1900s. We ended up, the progression, actually the facility that we're in right now, was home to two prior shoe manufacturing companies. And back in the 70s, I guess it would have been, most of the footwear industry was shifting offshore and it was drying up in this area. So, but there was a company called Mitchell Lace Incorporated who was manufacturing shoelaces to support the local footwear manufacturing capabilities here in town. and they moved into this building. They had been in business for over 100 years, and they went out of business in 2009, and we purchased the assets from when they shut down and started up business then.
We're in the middle of some big customization projects for New Balance right now. Those are the last two collars I need. Yeah.
What were they called?
Alpha Pink and Sea Spray.
I like Sea Spray.
Oh, I think that's probably one of the funner parts of the job is getting the name things. Collars.
Oh, you guys get to
it's
do
amazing
that?
Well, how you come up with new names all the time.
Yeah.
You think you'd run out of names.
We do. Sometimes we take their collar name and sometimes we make up our own. It just depends on who we're doing it for. Sometimes with New Balance, you try to use theirs because if you try to make up something, it just confuses them. So we try not to do that.
When we started up the former company that was here, they had actually gone more to becoming a distributorship. When they went out of business, we said, no, we want to go back to being a manufacturer in the United States. As a result of the economic downturn in the country, we were seeing more of a shift from consumers and from companies who were buying products to realize that there was a value in Made in USA products. So seeing that demand was there, plus that was really what we wanted to do. We wanted to manufacture in Portsmouth, Ohio, but in the United States.
The prior company had shifted some of their manufacturing offshore. A lot of their machines were basically put in mothballs. They just not being ran upstairs. So when we purchased the company, we bought the assets as well. And we were able to, within 30 days, get most of the company back up and running. Ryan mentioned the wealth of experience that we had. I still remember our first meeting with the employees before we even turned on the first machine. We hired approximately 15 people, if I remember correctly, and there was 300 years of manufacturing experience in that room. People that worked for the prior company that really knew how to run the machinery and get things going. And we immediately went into manufacturing. What orders we could salvage from the old company, we did. What customers we could salvage, we did. And then we started down the path of restoring the company and rebuilding the company and getting this wonderful American manufacturing experiment off the ground. And today we're very proud of what we've been able to accomplish.
A lot of versatility in narrow fabric weaving. We can do round, we can do oval, we can do flat. So we can do multiple shapes on the same machine. It all has to do with the mechanical setup of the machine. The cam design is all done internally. We do that, and that basically is what controls those heddles moving up and down. So that changes your weave pattern. And then all the rest of it is a matter of threading, determining the number of ends that come in the yarn, changing over the weaving systems, etc. What we did on the braid book, or we actually called it a more of a sample kit. What we did was we developed a concept by which we would take the various products and constructions, and these aren't everything that we've ever made. I mean, if you were really to look at what we have done in the past and what our true archive is, we're talking thousands and thousands of styles and constructions that have been developed in the past that we have on record. But we took some more common streamlined items and we broke it down by fiber type first. We looked at polyester, we looked at nylons, we looked at cottons, and tried to break down various shapes of products, whether it be round, flat, oval, for each one of those fiber types. And we actually took the lace product samples that we had made and we attached them to removable tags. So the designers could literally take a swatch of a material out of a book and they could hang it on their design boards, and when they're coming up with concepts, whether it be footwear or apparel or whatever, they could say, okay, I want this narrow fabric, this lace, this cord, whatever, to go with this project. And then we grayscaled that. So essentially when they're pulling the fabric, they're pulling a material that may be gray, black, or white, so that the collar didn't distract from the actual design detail of that product, whether it be the weave and the pick and so forth. And then we developed collar rings. So then once they selected their fiber type, their shape of their product, their size of their product, then they were able to pick and choose which collars they wanted within each fiber family. So hopefully we gave them a good palette, a representative palette of what they could select from. And literally it just became a process of kind of just matching up the style with the collar. And then beyond that, if it's something that gets tipped to length, we gave them different aglet options. So try to really break it down. And you know what we speak to a lot more seems to be the footwear side of things. So kind of one of the concepts behind when we were looking at this was how to build a shoelace.
again, our products have various applications and not just shoelaces, but really it was kind of a breaking it down how-to. It's a how-to guide of making a narrow fabric.
This is where we're actually taking the laces, we're pairing them up, and they're getting coiled up and banded.
So that's all done by hand.
This is very much so a person-to-machine ratio of banding. So really all we've done is we've taken the tip cord, and what it's doing is it's feeding into the machine. It's locking it into an apparatus behind this plate you can't see, where it's actually spinning it or winding it up, and then that spindle retracts. The lace gets pushed up and sandwiched down at the same time the wrapper is coming in over top of it, and then it all gets transferred over there, and then the wrapper gets overlapped and sealed to itself.
The American story is a wonderful story. The story of us coming in and saving a company and keeping employees working and saving an industry for a small town in America is a wonderful story. People love to hear that, and we get a lot of comments. People will comment on how that's great that you did this, and just so excited about what Soul Choice is all about and what we're trying to accomplish here. And everybody loves a good comeback story.
Monocle's Megan Billings there, reporting from the factory of Soul Choice, a shoelace company based in Portsmouth, Ohio. We're going to turn away from fashion now and end the show by looking at some signage. You'd be forgiven for not having heard of the annual Letterheads Meet, one of the more esoteric events on the design calendar. For over four decades, it's brought together signwriting enthusiasts from all over the world to exchange skills and socialise in a different city each year. This summer's edition was held in Amsterdam, and the main venue was the Volkshotel, a building that was once home to the progressive Dutch newspaper De Volkskrant. An appropriate place, then, to celebrate the world of letters.
I am Cheryl McLean, and I'm a blackboard artist from Australia. And I'm here to pass on my skills, to share what I've learned over the last 20 years with the next generation that are coming up and doing the same thing. So it's really, really a privilege to be here. I love it.
And you know, you can actually add movement lines to these to make them really jump.
I don't very often use chalk on the blackboard. It's a very difficult medium to work with, and it's not permanent and it smudges, and all that work doesn't last. So what I do is mostly commercial blackboards, and I have to be quick. And I use various products to suit what I'm actually drawing or writing. And I have learned to use these products in a way that I don't find many other people know. So that's why I'm here, to teach these guys things that they can do with products that they actually know about but don't know actually the full potential. It's a very much on-the-spot type of medium where you are creative and spontaneous, and it has that earthy, grainy, hand-done element to it that makes people notice it. And because of that, it's a fantastic advertising medium. It's also replaceable, whereas a lot of the traditional sign writing materials are permanent. So that what I'm using is very easy to just continually update or change completely without a big fuss. We're just flooded nowadays with stuff that's been produced by a computer. And people don't even notice it anymore. They look past it. And it just is a blur to people nowadays. So if you want something that's really going to stand out, it has to be done by hand. It has to look professional, but it has to have that real unique element to it. And I often find that this reflects into the businesses that I'm working for. And if they have a board that's done by hand out the front of their venue, it tells customers that this is a quality place, because they have gone the extra mile to have something that's very individual for them, as something that's really unique. And a couple of my clients have said, we have to pay to get you to come and do our boards regularly, because our customers are feeling that because we've got quality boards, we have quality food, quality cleanliness, quality staff, it reflects on our business.
So the medium itself is an advertisement?
Yes. People look at it because it's so different and they notice it. They go, oh, what's that? And I was one day doing a blackboard out the front of a restaurant. that was always empty. And this poor guy had only started up a few months before and couldn't attract the people. So I took a board and I put it out the front and I drew a burger and I did a menu. And people were watching me draw. And just that in itself was enough for people to notice this place. And so I finished it off. By the time I had finished it, the restaurant was full. The people started queuing up outside because they were looking at what I was doing, looking in the venue and going, wow. And they noticed it because it was done by hand. It's a wonderful medium for advertising. Look, I get beginners and advanced people all doing my course. The high majority of them are into graphic design or some form of lettering, but they see the value in learning to do professional hand lettering to give the stark harshness of a computer-driven font, to give it that softness and to bring in another layer of interest that makes their work that much more attractive.
And now it's bouncing. It's got life to it, and that's what you're distinctive...
The letterheads themselves could be broadly split into two groups. Veterans like Cheryl, who are there to teach workshops, and younger enthusiasts looking to learn the skills of the trade. To find out more about what attracts young designers to the event, I spoke to one of the students in Cheryl's workshop.
Hi, my name is Juliana Wiest. I'm from Berlin. I'm 32 years old and I'm a graphic designer. As a graphic designer, I just sit in front of the computer, have my mouse or my trackpad or whatever, and I'm not doing things with actually like drawing or painting. That's what I wanted to do. 3 years ago, when I was in Amsterdam for the first time, I explored all the nice lettering here, so I really got into that topic, and I was so interested that I wanted to do it also on like regular basis every now and then, but it was more like a hobby. But then I went to one workshop in Berlin with Mike Meyer, the sign painting workshop, and I'm just... There was a new world there, and from there I actually went and tried to do it every now and then. So, but then, you know, like real life kicked in and work, and you gotta make some money. So yeah, that was just the graphic designer thingy then, and now I just picked it up and took the opportunity to get here again. So I wanna, keep it up again and not lose it, you know, while real life is going on. So I wanna somehow include it. I don't know if I can make a living out of it, not yet probably, because I still need a lot of practice. It's not always just the glory in things. You gotta work hard for it. But that's something I would like to do, yeah.
Signs don't simply serve a commercial purpose. Designed to grab people's attention at street level, they're an important part of a city's overall look and feel. Gustavo Ferrari was teaching a workshop in a style of sign writing called filettiado. Developed in Buenos Aires by Italian immigrants in the late 19th century, it's now an important component of that city's visual identity.
Filettiado comes from the word filum of Latin, which means line. So it's like a decorative line, and porteño is the way the inhabitants of Buenos Aires, we call ourselves, like we are from a port city. So this is a style that I'm showing. It's a very traditional decorative style from Buenos Aires that has about 100 years old or a little bit more. And it was used in the beginning for decorating trucks and carts and buses. And now it's everywhere around the city in signs, shop windows and everything. And it has been declared World Cultural Heritage by UNESCO last year. So it's very important for us, this style. And so I'm showing it around Europe in workshops and tango festivals, and in this case, this letterhead meeting. This style of painting is based on ornamentation and scrolls, and it has a lot of traditional elements like flowers and dragons and birds and acanthus leaves that are maybe shared by other kind of decorative styles all around the world. But maybe what one of the things that make it more unique is the technical way we work, because we work especially with shades and lights and highlights, trying to make a 3D, three-dimensional feeling of depth and volume, and maybe that's what is more specific for us in the technique. And then the Argentinian things we paint inside, and the sayings that Filetiello was more known until the 70s because of the kind of sentences or phrases and sayings that they used to be painted, like traditional knowledge or sex jokes, and a little bit of mix of that. So it's mostly about that, the kind of sign writing we do and the technique itself.
And who do you work for? Who's commissioning signs from you?
Usually I work every Sunday in a street market in the touristic neighborhood of the city. So one of my main clients are buyers, are tourists that used to go visit in Argentina. So this style is like somehow the visual identity of our city. So everybody that goes to Buenos Aires wants to buy something like that as a souvenir. So one of my main clients are these tourists. Then I work a lot in Buenos Aires for shops and bars and restaurants to decorate the shop windows and to paint signs. And then, as the same way that the Filetteado is the image of a city, the tango is the music of a city. So it's a big relationship between both of them. So we also paint a lot of signs for people that have like tango academies or are teachers or are DJs in milongas. The milonga is the place where you dance tango. So I also make signs with the names of the places where you go to dance. And then one of my most strange and amazing customers in Buenos Aires is the US Embassy. I've been working with the US Embassy since 2011. So every time that they have an employee or an official worker there going back to the States or to some other destination in the world, they made me paint a Filetteado plate as a farewell plate. And it's really amazing because they told me that before they used to make something simple with like an acrylic plate or nothing else. And then they discover me and the Filetteado and they are really happy about it because they say, well, it has the feeling and the flavor of the city and it's something nice and hand-painted. So it's crazy because I've been doing like signs for Marines and for the FBI and things like that, and they really appreciate it.
Walking through the centre of Amsterdam in the evening, I had a newfound appreciation of quite how much the city's signage added to the atmosphere, especially the flowing crew letter script, hand-painted directly onto the windows of the city's historic cafes. If the enthusiasm of the attendees at the Letterheads meet is anything to go by, we can look forward to cities around the world benefiting from hand-painted signage well into the future. That's it for this week's show. My thanks to our editor, Alex Funnell. The show was produced by myself, Henry Rhys Sheridan. If you want to read about the stories that Jamie and Josh chatted about at the start of the show, and also Megan's full report from Soul Choice's Shoelace Factory, you can pick up the October edition of Monocle magazine at kiosk newsstands from the 15th of September, or better yet, subscribe at monocle.com. If you have any comments or queries, then feel free to drop me a line. I'm at hrs@monocle.com. And remember, we're back next week at the same time. You can always listen again or dip into our back catalogue at monocle.com, SoundCloud and iTunes. You've been listening to Section D. I'm Henry Rhys Sheridan. And until next time, it's goodbye from me.